The Sunstone Foundation presents The Shroud, Spirit Photographs, and the White Salamander, what they tell us about religious belief and sectarian histories, and why we believe as we do, Mormonism and the dynamics of religious belief. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Our second paper will be Why We Believe As We Do, Mormonism and the Dynamics of Religious Belief. The presenter will be Norman Kroller. He has an MSW PhD sociology from Indiana University. I see here he is the husband of Barbara Kroller, and he has two children. Joseph Bentley will be the commentator on this. He is a professor in organizational behavior and at the University of Utah. I'll now turn the time first to Paul Simmons to read Michael Homer's paper.
First of all, I feel that I should apologize for those of you who are coming expecting to hear Mike Homer. He's in Italy venerating the Shroud, and he asked me to fill in for him today. His paper is entitled The Shroud, Spirit Photographs, and the White Salamander, What They Tell Us About Religious Belief and Sectarian Histories. On October 15, 1985, two bombs exploded in Salt Lake City, Utah. The first bomb killed Stephen Christensen, a 31-year-old investment counselor who also served as a Mormon bishop in Centerville, Utah. The second bomb killed Kathleen Sheets, the wife of J. Gary Sheets, a former business associate of Christensen's who was in his 50s and, like Christensen, a Mormon bishop in an affluent East Bench ward. On the day following the deaths of Christensen and Sheets, a third bomb went off in a car owned by Mark Hoffman, who was severely injured and taken to a local hospital for treatment. Hoffman, like Christensen, was 31 years old and well-known in Mormon historical circles as a book and documents dealer. Since 1980, he had found numerous manuscripts, some of which were faith-promoting, which seemed to shed light on the early history of the church. These documents included the Anthon transcript and a handwritten note by Joseph Smith, which seemed to confirm the Mormon prophet's story regarding the origins of the Book of Mormon, and prompted a Harvard professor to claim that the correct translation of the transcript was strikingly similar to the first verse in 1 Nephi. He also found the Joseph Smith Third Blessing, which seemed to confirm our LDS claims that Joseph Smith had designated his eldest son to be his successor, a letter from Martin Harris to Walker Conrad, in which Harris recounted the vision he received when shown the gold plates, and the Lucy Max Smith letter, which also seemed to confirm Joseph Smith's earliest accounts of finding and translating the Book of Mormon. His most controversial find, however, a letter from Martin Harris to W.W. Phelps, known as the White Salamander, received the greatest publicity both inside and outside the Mormon Church because it appeared to confirm what Mormon historians had long thought, that Joseph Smith had been interested in the occult and magic from an early age, and that his interest may have influenced his teachings and prophecies during his 14-year tenure as prophet, seer, and revelator. Because of the controversial nature of the Hoffman documents, they were reviewed for their historical accuracy and also authenticated by handwriting experts. After receiving assurances of their authenticity, the church called the press to herald the discoveries of the Anthon transcript, the Lucy Max Smith letter, and the Martin Harris Walker Conrad letter. Each document was characterized as a faith-promoting, tangible proof of the Book of Mormon and compared with the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Joseph Smith III blessing was not treated with as much fanfare, neither was the White Salamander letter. But when news leaked out concerning these documents, their texts were also released, and with respect to the latter, extensive research was undertaken to prove that Martin Harris's use of the word salamander instead of angel did not contradict or conflict with Joseph Smith's version of finding the golden plates. Despite fears that the three bombings were the work of Mormon Danites or disgruntled investors and former customers of Sheets and Christensen, no further bombs exploded in Salt Lake City after October 16th. After Hoffman became a bombing victim, it became clear that the common links between the victims included not only their religious affiliations and Gary Sheets' company, but also the White Salamander letter, which was being studied, analyzed, and tested under the direction of Christensen, using money from Sheets' company. During the next year, a police investigation unraveled an extraordinarily complicated factual web which would rock the Mormon community nearly as much as the three explosions in October 1985. That investigation was based in part on newly conducted and more sophisticated tests, ultraviolet and microscopic examinations, and scanning auger microscopy dating, which revealed irregularities in the ink and provided a mechanism for determining its age. These tests concluded that the White Salamander letter and all of Hoffman's findings, including those which church spokesmen had compared to the Dead Sea Scrolls, were forgeries. When this evidence of deception was presented at the preliminary hearing, it became inevitable that Hoffman and his attorneys would attempt a plea bargain with prosecutors to avoid the possibility of capital punishment. After Hoffman pled guilty, subject to such an agreement in January 1987, he also agreed to reveal in detail how he had forged the documents and deceived historians, document and handwriting experts, and even officials of his own church. Between 1980 and 1985, the Hoffman documents came to be, for better or worse, the relics of early Mormonism. Other relics of the Book of Mormon, such as the Sword of Laban, the Liahona, the Urim and Thummim, and even the gold plates themselves, were not in the public domain. To fill that void, the Hoffman documents became the link between the early prophets of Mormonism and the present church membership. The effect Hoffman's forgeries had on well-intentioned church members is similar to the faith-promoting effect that traditional relics of Christianity have had in promoting faith. As historical objects, religious relics do not require an act of faith, but instead are aids to faith in a world which no longer believes in miracles. Shortly after Hoffman was incarcerated, preparations were being made on the other side of the world to test the most important religious relic of Christianity to determine its authenticity. The Shroud of Turin, which many Catholics believe is the burial cloth of Jesus, bears a pole image of a crucified man on it, including a front and back image with scourge marks, nails in the wrists and feet, wounds on the head and in the side of the body. Like other relics of the crucifixion, which include nails from the cross, of which Mark Twain said there were enough to fill a keg, thorns from the crown of thorns and splinters from the cross, the shroud has no proven genealogy to the time of Christ. In 1453, the present-day shroud came into the possession of Duke Louis of the House of Savoy and his wife, Anne Lusignan. Duke Louis' descendants retained possession of the shroud until 1983, when the last king of Italy, Umberto II, left it in his will to the Catholic Church. Some historians, however, claim that they can trace the shroud back at least 100 years prior to that time. In 1353, Geoffrey de Charny obtained permission to build a church on one of his estates located 12 miles west of Troyes in Lyrie, France. The reason he wanted to build a church was to install a shroud and expose it for public veneration, which he did. In 1389, de Charny was criticized in a letter written by the Bishop of Troyes, Pierre Darcy, to Pope Clement VII in Avignon, in which he charged that de Charny and his family had falsely and deceitfully, being consumed with the passion of avarice and not from any motive of devotion, but only of gain, procured for their church a certain cloth cunningly painted, upon which by clever sleight of hand was depicted the twofold image of one man, that is to say, the back and front, they falsely declaring and pretending that this was the actual shroud in which our Savior Jesus Christ was enfolded in the tomb. Because of these claims, the bishop investigated the matter and determined that it had first been exhibited in Lyrie some 30 years earlier. And further, Bishop Henri of Poitiers had discovered the fraud and how the said cloth had been cunningly painted, the truth being attested by the artist who had painted it, to wit, that it was a work of human skill and not miraculously wrought or bestowed. Finally, Bishop Darcy pleaded with the Pope that this could not be the real shroud of our Lord, having the Savior's likeness thus imprinted upon it, since the Holy Gospel made no mention of any such imprint. While if it had been true, it was quite unlikely that the holy evangelists would have omitted to record it, or that the fact should have remained hidden until the present time. Despite this complaint, no action was taken to Charny to prohibit him from displaying the shroud at his church. If this shroud was the same which eventually came into the possession of the House of Savoy, it is interesting that in 1506, Pope Julius II, at the request of the Duke of Savoy, granted the shroud official status as one of the holiest relics of Christendom and created a feast day for it on May 4th. From that time until 1578, the shroud remained in Chambéry, which was the capital of the House of Savoy, and was stored in a silver casket locked behind a grille set into the wall of the Sainte-Chapelle. On the evening of December 4th, 1532, the shroud was partially destroyed by a fire when drops of molten silver fell over the edges of the shroud's folds. 2 years later, patches were sewn onto the shroud by a team of Poor Clare nuns. 44 years later, in 1578, the shroud was moved to the new capital of the House of Savoy in Turin, where it remains to this day in a special chapel constructed between the Cathedral of San Giovanni and the Royal Palace. Since obtaining relic status, at least 35 popes, from Sixtus IV to Paul VI, have commented on the importance of the shroud. Pope Pius XI declared in 1936 that it is a sacred thing, perhaps more than any other. More recently, Paul VI commented on the miracle of being able to see the actual image of Christ. Likewise, the secular rulers who owned the shroud made it a sacred palladium and displayed it in their coat of arms and summoned its power in battle. It was put on public display during public celebrations, during times of crisis, and in preparation for battles. It was during such a display in 1898, during the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Italian Constitution, that the King of Italy, Umberto I, gave permission to a Torino lawyer, Secundo Pia, to photograph the shroud for the first time. Pia was in awe when he saw the image on the photographs. Although he was only an amateur photographer, he noted that without the photographs, the image on the relic was almost indistinguishable. However, the negative of the photograph showed a clearly visible figure which, for the first time, gave form and notoriety to the Shroud of Turin, and which set it apart from other relics of the Middle Ages. Additional photographs were taken of the shroud in 1931, when it was displayed during the celebration of the reign of King Vittorio Emanuele II. In 1969, for the first time in color, in conjunction with the appointment of a commission of experts to suggest methods of best conserving the holy relic, and again in 1973, when it was displayed for the first time on television throughout Europe and into parts of South America. Finally, in 1978, the shroud was displayed for 6 weeks during the celebration of its 400th anniversary of being brought to Turin. While on public exhibition, over 3 million people made the pilgrimage to Turin. In 1978, the second international conference on the shroud was also held in Turin in conjunction with its exhibition. A Congress of Specialists had first taken place in 1939, but the first Congress of International Proportions had occurred in Rome and Turin in 1950. 9 years later, the International Center of Sindonology was formed, and its journal, Sindon, published scientific findings concerning the shroud. The second international conference in 1978 was attended by textile experts, hematologists, historians, genealogists, theologians, forensic scientists, physicists, photographers, criminologists, space scientists, art historians, and others, who discussed their findings concerning the authenticity of the shroud. This group of professionals, which make up the Shroud of Turin Research Project, or STURP, included not only Catholics, but members of various other religious denominations, including at least two Mormons. Although no attempt was made to draw definite conclusions, most speakers agreed that the scientific evidence overwhelmingly favored the authenticity of the shroud, including the unique negative imprint, which is observable by photograph, the proportionality of the body, the consistency of the shroud image with what is known about the crucifixion, the image of scourge marks, nails, thorns, and wounds in the side of the body, the presence of Middle East pollen, chemistry tests, which demonstrated that there was hemoglobin, and the three-dimensionality of the body when subjected to tests by a VP8 image analyzer. There were a few, however, who continued to doubt its authenticity, particularly in light of the early account of forgery written by Bishop Darcy. The fact that there were many forgeries of religious relics made in the 13th and 14th centuries to encourage pilgrims to come to the churches where they were located, and the fact that there is no conclusive history of the shroud prior to the Middle Ages. In addition, some scientists claim to have found the presence of iron oxide and paint pigments on the shroud, which they believe demonstrated that it was a painting rather than the image of Christ. Even these experts agreed, however, that no definitive conclusion concerning the authenticity of the shroud could be given until carbon dating tests were made of its material. Ian Wilson, who believed the shroud was authentic, concluded his address by suggesting that carbon dating of shroud samples be completed immediately at the conclusion of the conference. Others argued that carbon testing results would not be conclusive because of the presence of pollen and other live organisms on the shroud. And some STIRP delegates suggested in 1984 that studies be done to determine the effect that contamination from microorganisms, pollen, and live bacteria would have on the carbon dating process before the carbon dating tests were done. Rather than follow STIRP's recommendation, the Archbishop of Turin agreed to submit the shroud to carbon dating testing in April 1988. When the results of the carbon dating tests were made public on October 13, 1988, the conclusion was that the linen of the Shroud of Turin is medieval. It did not convince everyone, however. One who remained dubious was Thomas J. Phillips of Harvard, who argued that because the Shroud could have been subjected to a unique physical event, namely the resurrection of a dead body, that a carbon dating test may not be accurate. He said, "Unfortunately, this event is not accessible to direct scientific scrutiny. But the image on the shroud, which still cannot be duplicated, appears to be a scorch, indicating that the body radiated light and or heat. It may also have radiated neutrons, which would have irradiated the shroud and changed some of the nuclei to different isotopes by neutron capture." Another group, known as the Association of Scientists and Scholars International for the Shroud of Turin, or ASSIST, also questions the accuracy of the results for several reasons. First, shroud samples were taken from only one corner of the shroud, very near the area where it was scorched and water damaged during the fire of 1532. Second, the linen cloth at that location may have undergone some reweaving following the fire, introducing 16th century fibers into the original cloth at the point where the sample was removed. Third, the carbon-based materials on the surface of the flax fibers where the fire occurred may have been dissolved and transported into the fibers or into the very molecular structure of the flax. All of these factors, according to ASSIST, could have skewed the results of the carbon testing. Another evangelical scholar, Gary Habermas, who co-authored a book on the shroud, admits that although the new evidence made him more skeptical about the authenticity of the shroud, there is still some concern in the scientific community regarding several specific problems in the testing procedures. He is hopeful that more testing will take place because if the shroud is authentic, it offers incredible proof of the crucifixion and possibly the resurrection. Another religious movement which offered tangible proofs of immortality to those steeped in materialism was spiritualism. These tangible proofs consisted of mental mediumship, wherein messages were received through mediums at seances, and physical mediumship, wherein incorporeal spirits actually materialized. With respect to mental mediumship, spiritualists admit that those of differing religious persuasions who claim to be recipients of supernatural experiences are not all frauds. For example, an editor of Tiffany's magazine in 1859, who was a spiritualist, interviewed Martin Harris and used the interview to support his position that Joseph Smith was under the guidance of lower grade spirits. Similarly, both the Godbeites and Arthur Conan Doyle admitted that Joseph Smith was a medium, but doubted that his guides were teaching him the truth. Thus, spiritualism admits the possibility that its adherents, although not frauds, may be misguided in the interpretation of their experiences. Just as photography gave a new dimension to the relic of the shroud, spirit photographs provided spiritualism with new forms of tangible proof of communications with the dead. Some photographs consisted of materialized spiritual forms taken at seances. Spiritualists believe that during the visitation of some spirits, a gelatinous material called ectoplasm oozed from the medium's mouth, ears, eyes, and skin and formed around the spirit to give it a visible, three-dimensional shape. Other spirit photographs were taken of persons or groups in daylight where no spiritual forms were visible, but which, when developed, showed spirits that had mysteriously appeared on the negatives. Art? Pardon? Sure. I haven't figured it out yet. Arthur Conan Doyle, who is almost as well known in some circles for his advocacy of spiritualism as he is for being the creator of Sherlock Holmes, was one of the greatest proponents of tangible proofs of the spirit world. In addition to being an indefatigable proselytizer for spiritualism, Conan Doyle was an amateur photographer who had written several books on the subject and advocated that spirit photographs were proof that life existed beyond death, and in that respect, a religious relic of the departed. But Conan Doyle also knew that even photographs could be faked for effect. He had submitted faked photographs himself to the publisher of The Lost World, a book he wrote in 1912, which showed a plateau where species from another world existed and were discovered by human beings. Thus, when Conan Doyle explained in his books why the spirit photographs he discussed were not faked, he noted that they had been examined for evidence of double exposures, explained that the film used to photograph was brought to the seance and loaded in the camera without handling by the medium, and that there were no photographs similar to those of the departed spirits, which were known to exist prior to the deaths of the subjects. Nevertheless, no experts of the reputation of those who had vouched for the Hoffman documents and the Holy Shroud stepped forward to defend Conan Doyle's photographs. But this did not deter his belief in them and other evidences of supernatural life. Perhaps the most bizarre episode of Conan Doyle's life was his expressed belief in photographs taken by two girls in Yorkshire, which showed the presence of fairies. Before accepting the photographs as genuine, he had the negatives of the photographs examined for evidence of double exposure. When no such double exposure was detected, he wrote letters to the press, an article in Strand magazine, and even a small book in which he argued strenuously that not only were the photographs genuine, but also that they demonstrated the existence of new forms of life. As his acceptance of these photographs became more and more controversial, he tried to distance his advocacy of them from his proselytism for spiritualism. Of course, fairy photographs have nothing to do with spiritualism, which is conceived wholly with destiny of the whole human soul, he wrote. Yet, although he attempted to differentiate his belief in fairies from his belief in spiritualism, both beliefs were really premised upon a belief in the revelation of extraterrestrial forms to human beings. After Doyle went to his grave believing in the fairy photographs, both girls admitted that they had deceived him by photographing cardboard forms taken from a child's book of poetry. Nevertheless, one of them insisted that she had really seen the fairies, but that she had falsified the photographs in order to create a false proof of a true story. There are significant differences between the Shroud of Turin, the Hoffman forgeries, and spirit photographs. First, the Holy Shroud is a religious relic in the traditional sense, that is, a physical object associated with the Passion of Christ or the life of a saint or a miraculous event, since it is claimed that it contains the imprint of Christ. The Hoffman documents contained only the written and subjective accounts of mortals who claim to have had supernatural experiences, and the spirit photographs claim to bear the images of immortal images. Second, the shroud is recognized as a relic by Christians throughout the world, even by non-Roman Catholics, whereas the Hoffman documents and spirit photographs were accepted by only two small groups of what many Christians would refer to as sects. Third, the Shroud of Turin has been venerated for at least 600 years, and even after the carbon dating tests, continues to be so. The Hoffman documents were believed in for at most 5 years and are now universally recognized as fraudulent. The spirit photographs of spiritualism were in vogue for less than 50 years and, like the Hoffman documents, are no longer taken seriously by anyone. Fourth, even if the shroud is medieval, no one claims to know how to duplicate it, whereas the Hoffman documents and spirit photographs can be duplicated. Fifth, the shroud has been subjected to dozens of tests which have convinced scientists from throughout the world of its authenticity. The Hoffman documents were subjected to some initial testing, but nothing approaching the shroud. And in retrospect, their authentication was based on faulty assumptions concerning the handwriting of early church leaders and superficial tests concerning the age of the ink and paper. The spirit photographs, on the other hand, were accepted, ironically, largely on faith rather than any scientific analysis. Yet, despite these differences and others, there are also some interesting parallels. First, these relics originated within religious movements which claimed to be the only legitimate method for completely understanding God and returning to his presence. Both Mormonism and Catholicism claim to be the only true church, and spiritualism places all religious experiences in a spiritualistic context, claiming that people as diverse as Bernadette and Joseph Smith did not fully understand their supernatural experience. Second, each religion's belief in the supernatural is constantly challenged by a world which lives amidst crises and uncertainty and is attracted by naturalistic and scientific explanations. Darwinists, materialists, humanists, and atheists view their claims as naive and simplistic. Catholics, and with them Christians of all denominations, are told that there is no proof that Christ was really resurrected, and that the Bible has little historical validity, but is largely allegorical and symbolic. Critics of Mormonism attack the anachronisms of the Book of Mormon, its verbatim quotations from the King James Bible, and note that the social issues contained in its pages are strikingly similar to those discussed in the early 19th century. Similarly, the critics of spiritualism note the many frauds perpetrated by mediums and remind the world that one of the Fox sisters, who is one of the original mediums through which spiritualism was established, admitted and then denied that she was a fake. Third, amidst these criticisms, adherents of these religious beliefs are attracted by tangible proofs which seem to confirm their beliefs and provide a rational basis to demonstrate the truth of religious experiences and dogma. Thus, Catholics are assured by Marian apparitions, a pious parishioner who is blessed with the stigmata, modern miracles which result in canonization and holy relics, such as the shroud, which support scriptural accounts. Likewise, Mormons take comfort in the internal and external evidences which seem to support their beliefs in the divine origin of the Book of Mormon, as well as world events which appear to fulfill Latter-day prophecy and claims of continuing revelation by church leaders. Finally, spiritualists continue to be confirmed in their beliefs by apparitions at seances, spirit photographs, and table wrappings. In this context, the documents located by Mark Hoffman, which were faith-promoting, provided a great comfort to the faithful inasmuch as they confirmed cherished beliefs that Charles Anthon did confirm the ancient origin of the Book of Mormon, that Joseph Smith did bless his son to become his successor, that Joseph Smith's mother did confirm the divine origin of his work. And even the so-called White Salamander letter had a galvanizing effect inasmuch as it offered church theologians and historians a challenge to explain why it was not unreasonable or inconsistent with the basic tenets of church history that Martin Harris would refer to an angel as a white salamander. That Mormons would seek this type of proof is totally consistent with the beliefs and aspirations of the earliest church leaders. An editorial in the Times and Seasons in 1842 predicted that the world will prove Joseph Smith the true prophet by circumstantial evidence in experiments as they did Moses and Elijah. B.H. Roberts, patron saint of the Mormon intellectuals, spent a good portion of his life chronicling the proofs of Joseph Smith's claims, the validity of the Book of Mormon as a New Testament for Christ and the church as his true church upon the earth. In one of the forewords to Volume 2 of his New Witnesses for God, published in 1909, Roberts quoted George Rawlinson as follows: "There is an increasing readiness to make the choicest gifts of modern science and learning tributary to the Word of God. New evidences of their credibility and accuracy are continually coming to light. If any new forms of evidence should hereafter be needed to meet any new forms of unbelief and authenticate afresh the word of truth, they will be found deposited somewhere. God will bring them forth. Incidentally, in another foreword in the same book, Roberts also quoted the Reverend John Watson, who observed, "If a veritable picture of the Lord could be unearthed from a catacomb, and the world could see with its own eyes what like he was, it would not matter that its colors were faded and that it was roughly drawn. That picture would have at once a solitary place amid the treasures of art." Although Watson was not referring to the Shroud of Turin, the reference to the picture of the Lord is similar to a later statement made by Pope Paul VI. In any event, Roberts believed that the Book of Mormon provided the type of proof and evidence written of by both Rawlinson and Watson. More recent efforts to prove the Book of Mormon through archaeology and linguistic analysis are extensions of Roberts' approach. The Hoffman documents were readily accepted because they were additional proofs of the divine mission of Joseph Smith and the validity of the Book of Mormon, and as such were quoted in various accounts of the Restoration published prior to the 1985 bombings. The Roman Catholic belief in relics and miracles is also premised on the assumption that not only do relics from the Passion of Christ and articles associated with the bodies and lives of saints provide a tangible link between Christ and the present, but that miracles have and continue to be reported by those who come in contact with such relics. Many have been healed by the Shroud. Because of these miracles, which have been continuous since the life of Christ, the Shroud and all relics are proofs of the Christian message. This was particularly evident in 1973 when the Shroud was shown on television for the first time. An observer of the event noted that one sensed that in agreeing to the exposition, Cardinal Pellegrino, Archbishop of Turin, tacitly acknowledged a real 20th century need, the need to find an antidote to doubt, the need for some tangible evidence of Christ in an age that demands proof for everything. As with the Hoffman documents, it is improbable that those who already believed by faith would be affected greatly if the Shroud were not scientifically proved. However, if it could be scientifically proven to be the true burial cloth of Christ, it was looked upon as a great opportunity to reverse unbelief in the world. Similarly, Arthur Conan Doyle's advocacy of spirit photographs and fairy photographs demonstrates his deep-seated belief that tangible proofs were available to man and that even materialists could believe in the hereafter without having to rely on dogma and superstition. Although raised in a very strict Roman Catholic family, Conan Doyle became convinced that every mystery in life could be solved only through observation and deductive reasoning. He criticized throughout his life those religions which requested their followers to accept teachings on faith alone. Instead, Conan Doyle insisted, "I must have a definite demonstration, for if it were to be a matter of faith, then I might as well go back to the faith of my fathers. Never will I accept anything which cannot be proved to me. The evils of religion have all come from accepting things which cannot be proved." Yet he still wanted to believe that life continued after death. Thus, using both religion and science, Conan Doyle, and with him many other intellectuals of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, hoped to break down the barrier of death to found the grand religion of the future through the observation of supernatural phenomena. So what do the religious relics discussed in this paper tell us about religious belief and sectarian histories? First, that relics are an important ingredient in those religions which believe in the miracles of the Bible, that supernatural events continue to occur today, and that they are endowed with authority and legitimacy above all other churches. Second, that although these relics are revered, the churches are hesitant to give them official recognition for fear that they may be found, as they often are, to be fraudulent. Third, that even though they may not be officially recognized, believers and historians do not hesitate to rely on the relic as proof for the claims of that religion. Fourth, even though believers and non-believers alike are attracted by items more tangible than faith to support their belief in a hereafter, the finding that a relic is a fraud will not destroy faith, just as its proof does not destroy disbelief. Even though each religious relic was finally demonstrated to be of dubious authenticity, and there is evidence in each case that their creators admitted to their fraud, the faith of those who believed was not greatly affected. Mormons were assured that church officials had not sought the documents and never officially recognized their validity. In addition, they were relieved that some of the conclusions drawn from the documents, for example, that Joseph Smith ordained his son to succeed him, and that he was influenced by magic and the occult, were not supported by the documents and may be overcolored and exaggerated. Similarly, the Roman Catholic Church has never made outright official claims that the Shroud of Turin is the burial cloth of Christ, and even after the announcement of the carbon dating results, the Archbishop of Turin, Cardinal Anastasio Balestrero, proclaimed that it was but another chapter in the Shroud story, or, as some would say, in the mystery of the Shroud. More recent pronouncements by the new Archbishop are even more cautious. He notes that the carbon dating tests have still not established how the Shroud may have been created, and that if it is a product of the Middle Ages, it may even be a greater miracle than previously thought, since God has put his stamp on it without explanation. Finally, even though many spirit photographs have been demonstrated fraudulent, spiritualists continue to see with their own eyes proofs of the hereafter, doubt that all physical evidence of the afterlife could be faked, and believe that the chaff must be separated from the wheat. Thus, even though the relics of Catholicism, Mormonism, and spiritualism have been advanced to believers to confirm their faith, and to non-believers to bridge the gap between faith and materialism, it is doubtful that they serve either purpose. Many non-believers may be intrigued, and believers may be comforted, but it is the less tangible proofs of religion, faith, belief, and feeling, which remain the real convincing elements of any religion, even in a day of disbelief.
Is the microphone working? Do I need to speak up? Okay. I have a paper to read, and I will read, I guess, much of the paper. But I'd also like to give a talk a little, I guess. I'd like to give you a little background about the paper and why I decided to put it together and what happened since I decided to put it together, and some of my motivation for this particular topic. And I think the motivation stemmed from kind of a frustration from past Sunstone symposia that focused on sort of the content of belief rather than the process of belief. And something I've grown up with as a Mormon, I guess, where we argue over beliefs on their merits without really examining why we may want to or not want to believe what's being argued. And so I sketched out a paper with an approximate title of the one you see in the program some months ago and began working on that in the same time as I was moving from Utah to Oregon and starting a new business and having stuff packed in boxes. But I'd sketched out a paper and returned here to see my family once every 6 or so weeks. And returning in May, I saw an announcement on my desk for a B.H. Roberts presentation that had just passed. And the topic by talk by Joseph Bentley was entitled, "We Believe Easily What We Hope For Earnestly." So I spent some part of my visit here trying to track down some kind of copy to see what he had said, which I finally did. And he dealt with, in some ways, some of the things I was wanting to do. By background and training, I'm a sociologist, and Dr. Bentley is a psychologist, and so he dealt with things a little differently than I might have. But I'm going to quote him in this paper a couple of places. So let me tell you a little bit about what I want to do and what I don't want to do. The content of belief refers to the what of belief. And I sat through several sessions today in which there's sort of a debate over the validity of certain approaches to gospel topics, and it left the audience guessing what the speaker's motivation was, that is, what they truly believed, and from their arguments, what they were trying to defend. And, you know, we see this all the time. I like very much Dr. Bentley's title, namely, "We Believe Easily What We Hope For Earnestly." And the implication there is sort of that when we wish to believe something, when it supports us in certain other ways, when it's infused with our identity, then we believe these things easily, accepting some kinds of evidence and maybe rejecting other kinds of evidence. So let me proceed with the paper. I put together kind of a draft of the paper. I sent a copy to several people, including Dr. Bentley, with a note that I would revise the paper, which I have not been able to do. It's been a horrible month. And a week before my house was to close in Utah, the people backed out after having closed with a house in Oregon and being caught between the two. And it's been kind of a mess. So I came back to my paper this week, read it through again, and felt I wanted to put it through some revisions. And so I'm going to do that by making a couple of comments about what I've written as I go along. So I'm going to stop at several places. In Henry Fielding's novel, Tom Jones, the character, Mr. Thwackum, declares, "When I mention religion, I mean the Christian religion. And not only the Christian religion, but the Protestant religion. And not only the Protestant religion, but the Church of England." Like Mr. Thwackum, when most people think of religion, they have their own in mind. To talk about why people believe as they do is to invite an argument. Each person has beliefs which are part of his or her identity. We feel a particular ownership of those beliefs which make sense of the world for us and describe our place in it. We may be threatened when the basis for such beliefs or their validity is questioned. We may be threatened when the basis of the belief is even examined. For part of my academic career, I taught in a college in North Carolina, which was in fact sponsored by the Presbyterian Church. And I think in 7 years of teaching, I had three Mormon students. And the affiliation with the Presbyterian Church was probably not as strong as BYU is with the Mormon Church, but it was nevertheless there, and it was fairly constant. And one of my areas of teaching was the sociology of religion. And one of the goals I had in the sociology of religion, among other things, is to bring students to gain an appreciation and a feel for religions other than their own. And I found that about the only way that one could do that is to get one to interact with folks in other religion or other religions. And so one of the assignments I devised, and I thought, oh, this is going to be wonderful, is that I drew up two lists of names of churches. And one list was churches that were characterized by a high formal liturgy, the Catholic Church, the Episcopalian Church. And then the second list was a list of churches whose form of worship was more down-to-earth and more emotional and more personal, the Southern Baptist, Four Square Gospel Church, churches of that nature. And so the assignment was this. Each student was to attend one church on each of the two lists, and they could not attend their own church if their church was on one of the lists. If they wanted to substitute, I had to approve their new choice. But what I was trying to do is get them to go to, two different churches and that had very different styles of worship. And then the paper that they were to write and what we were to discuss was what were they getting or feeling, or what was the church doing to them or for them, and how did the one style contrast to the other style? And it sounded nice in theory, and I think it was a good exercise for a lot of folks, but not for all. What I found was that some students felt or wrote or said later that this was a really important part of the class. It brought a lot of things to life that we were studying in the sociology of religion. Other students found it extremely difficult thing to do. Several refused absolutely. And some of them, a few over the years, said it was absolutely against their religious belief to attend another church. That class, I guess, was to interact with people of different faiths, even though the majority of students were Southern Protestants. So after many semesters of teaching the sociology of religion during a career of teaching sociology and psychology, I left, came to Utah, and went into another business, namely that of working with people. And one of the things I've done for the last decade is worked in the area of counseling. And counseling troubled individuals during the past decade has given me further insight into how personal beliefs function in individual lives. So from this background, I should like to discuss some of the important findings about how and why we believe as we do. And in doing so, I should like to suggest that for some people, myself included, there are a number of compelling reasons for this kind of examination of religious beliefs. Now, given the time, I've got about 18 minutes, and we're going to have to... The session ends at 6. We want to give Dr. Bentley some time to respond. So I'm going to skip pieces of the presentation. What I talk about, and I'm going to summarize, I guess, rather than read. What I talk about for the next couple of pages is I give kind of a defense of an academic study of religion, not just from the point of view of academic people, but from the point of view of everyone. And what I'm saying here essentially is that if we go at religion from an academic point of view, are we not neglecting the spiritual? Are we not backing ourselves into a hole whereby we talk ourselves out of our faith, where we rationalize, where we see other than spiritual dimensions in religion, and we fall into apostasy, I guess. And what I'm arguing is that that's not necessarily the case. If we see religion, the spiritual versus the intellectual, in a dualistic way, so that they're not combined at all, I argue that we may get into more trouble than if we look at things in an intellectual way. Let me go back to reading a little bit. Of interest is the fact that the church itself sponsors considerable social science research, with at least some of it bearing on questions I consider in this paper. One problem is that the research is not widely known because much of it apparently is not publicly available. That is, some of it comes out in certain kinds of articles or in certain ways. Much of it does not. But in any case, at least someone in authority is convinced that this is tithing money well spent, and considerable money at that. But papers that have been published indicate that the Research and Evaluation Division of the Correlation Department has examined such topics as reasons for dropping out of religious activity, the impact of church programs and activities on the development of faith. They have worked to measure religiosity, measure religious experience and religious change. And in fact, a nationally well-known non-Mormon sociologist has commented of this research effort, and I'm quoting, "Through the years, I have consulted with many denominational research departments, and I have read countless reports or their results. I have often been favorably impressed, yet the research efforts of other denominations shrink to insignificance when compared with the quality, scope, and sophistication of the work of the Mormon social research movement." For the remainder of the paper, I discuss 6 ideas, which I believe summarize important research findings about the nature of beliefs and why we come to believe as we do. And then I conclude with some possible reasons why these are important, not just in an academic setting, but in a personal and spiritual sense as well. And these main 6 ideas are roughly summarized as follows. Religious beliefs comprise systems which hang together in consistent ways for individuals. That's number 1. Number 2, the world is organized and perceived by means of these belief systems. Number 3, a person's self-concept is inseparably linked to his or her belief system. 3, beliefs are shaped by the historical circumstances of a person's life. 5, beliefs very often stem from behavior. And 6, the major influence on people and how they believe is other people. Beliefs hang together. An individual does not merely subscribe to a collection of unrelated beliefs which he or she picks up over the years. Rather, a person's beliefs comprise a system of related opinions which often hang together in predictable ways. Now, to say that a person's belief system is predictable or consistent, I must add, is not to say that it is necessarily logical or rational. For example, A neighbor says that one of his strong beliefs is freedom and free will. And for this reason, he is strongly opposed to any restrictions of gun ownership and is adamantly against affirmative action legislation. On the other hand, this same freedom-loving neighbor strongly believes a woman's place is in the home, and he vigorously supports not only excommunication but prison terms for consenting adults who engage in homosexual behavior. Not strictly deductive logic, you say, but somehow predictable. Well, one thing we do know is that people compartmentalize their beliefs. If from a strictly deductible, a sense of deductive logic, we were trying to look at a person's belief system, we find that in the sense of logic, people's beliefs aren't very logical at all in many cases. We know that people compartmentalize their beliefs. But I found, particularly in counseling, that even they do this in systematic, predictable ways. People's beliefs and their behavior often differ, but they often differ in very predictable ways and inconsistent ways. But what I mean by this point is that it is some degree of shared belief or beliefs that allow people to live together in groups. For example, whenever we use a term like liberal or conservative, or like Mormon or Baptist, we refer to some kinds of beliefs which hang together in some ways to provide a commonality among people. So this is not to say that there's not a lot of inconsistency among people's beliefs, but that how a person responds to a new idea is determined at least in part by how it fits in with the person's already existing ideas. Now, before we charge someone with being inconsistent, however, we should look further for an underlying basis tying beliefs together. And an example might illustrate this. Researchers have often found that the verbal commitment to Christian ethics to be unrelated to actual behavior. For example, even though a religious denomination takes an outspoken stand against racial prejudice, members who are otherwise orthodox may appear prejudiced in their behavior. I cite a California study that found that over 90% of both Protestant and Catholic church members agreed with the following two ideas in the study. A, love thy neighbor means that we should treat all races the same. And B, blacks ought to have the same rights and responsibilities of others. Yet over 40% of the same people in this particular study said they would move if black families moved into their neighborhoods. A third did not want blacks in their churches. Does this mean that some of these folks are inconsistent or illogical? Well, not necessarily. Several researchers looking a little deeper into the same kind of data suggest that there are other underlying themes in Christian doctrine, depending on their interpretation, which may contribute to prejudice rather than diminish it. And a key example of one of these central beliefs is the radical version of the free will of man. This view sees man as free to choose and affect his own destiny or salvation regardless of his circumstances. Such thinking, in fact, recognizes that without responsibility, punishment for sin and the need for repentance makes little sense. While some of us also take into account the effect of environment or behavior, others, including some of the most active church members, subscribe to this radical free will belief. This, in turn, leads to a very conservative views on civil rights. So from this thinking, one might put the blame on the disadvantage for their disadvantages. As one author points out, it is not that these Christians support the forces that deprive black Americans or any other minorities. It is rather that they do not recognize the existence or the magnitude of such forces. Psychologist Behm uses the term psychologic rather than logic to describe the consistency of belief systems. Logic appears to be in the mind of the believer rather than in the mind of the observer. Second point, and I'm going to have to skip some of these, I suppose. I follow a little bit of the line that Bentley does in his recent B.H. Roberts presentation entitled, We Believe Easily What We Hope For Earnestly. Bentley points out that our beliefs, including our religious beliefs, form patterns or what he calls schemas, and that these schemas act as cognitive maps or models by which all perception and experience is organized or interpreted. The point is that we don't somehow perceive the world in an objective sense, but that we can only make sense of things through the theories or schemas which we construct. Additionally, this is normally an unconscious process. Two people can give dramatically different accounts of supposedly the same experience. Their cognitive models direct their attention to some things and not to others. To each, however, it seems as though he or she is merely seeing what is obviously there. One thing I wanted to do is to provide a couple of examples, particularly at this hour in the day. And one of the best examples, and I'm not going to go into this in great detail, and I might refer it to you if you're a Sunstone reader, appeared in a recent Sunstone article by David Knowlton. And this was a talk given in last year's symposium entitled Missionary, Native, and General Authority Accounts of a Bolivian Conversion. It's the February 1989 issue. And what Knowlton does is to illustrate the considerable differences in interpretive models between people of two cultures. And he describes the case of the baptism of a large number of peasants in a small remote Bolivian village in 1976. And he looks at the differing accounts as told by the missionaries who were involved, by the church news which reported this particular instance, by a general authority who included in a general conference talk a description of what happened, and then finally, Knowlton is an anthropologist and a former missionary in Bolivia, spent time with some of the people who were involved in the conversion. The church news and general authority accounts, as Knowlton illustrates, translates the story into cultural understandings of Anglo-Mormons. In fact, Mormon folk traditions easily filled the basic details of conversion which Mormons take for granted, or filled in the basic details of conversion which Mormons take for granted. In the Anglo-Mormon account, the stress was on the miraculous, the desire to hear the gospel on the part of the folks involved. Personal testimony is crucial for conversion, and the importance of the feeling on the part of the folks, the converts, that the Book of Mormon is true and that this is a true church. What Knowlton does in his article is he goes on to show that the actual motivations cited by the Bolivians themselves were substantially different and had to be understood from the standpoint of their circumstances and their culture. They had a very different understanding of our concepts of religion, worship, and conversion. What it meant to be a believer had a very different meaning for those people than it did for us in our culture. And this is not merely a case of getting the facts wrong. Knowlton concludes, and I'll quote from his conclusion briefly. Here we have seen myths told from the pulpit or in church publications as didactic validations of faith that really only minimally correspond to what actually happened. Are they therefore false and untrue? No, they merely raise for analysis our conflicting assumptions about truth. At such moments of conflict, of clashing expectations, we can probably learn more about truth than at any other time. Okay. Skipping over another great deal of material, point three. Self-concept is linked to one's belief system. In fact, not only is self-concept linked to one's belief system, but it is part of one's self-concept. That is, one's belief system is part of one's self-concept. Orson Scott Card, writing in a recent issue of Sunstone, describes his reaction to his first exposure to hardcore anti-Mormon literature. And I'm quoting from Card. As I read the pamphlets, I never felt my faith challenged, but I found myself getting deeply angry because I imagined other people reading this stuff and thinking it was true. I found myself filled with helpless rage at how these people were creating a false image of Mormonism. They were defining for many other people what the name Mormon stands for. They were defining the most powerful of the communities that comprise my identity. Therefore, they were defining me. I seethed for days. It still hurts to remember, for even though my faith is unchallenged by them, my public identity is profoundly challenged. So Card describes well the emotions which are unleashed when our core identities are threatened. I think it's a little naive to believe that his public identity and his faith is so separate as he claims. Okay. What I need to do, I suppose, is leave the text, most of which remains unread, and summarize just a bit. Probably the main point, which comes at the last, which you're not going to hear, As a sociologist, it's probably the bias and the thing that's come through to me in my work is that faith is defined and created and maintained in relationship to community. And that as we go through life, we develop a religious identity in one way or another. And that religious identity is defined, created, and maintained in relationship to community. And if we would understand one's faith, we need to understand the community of which one is a part. And part of this formation of faith is faith as forming of emotions. And so let me go back to my summary and conclusions. And some of this may be hard to follow since you haven't heard most of the paper. I have summarized some major themes or ideas which I believe describe important findings and conclusions of why people believe as they do. This discussion was meant to illustrate some of these ideas and not to be an exhaustive treatment of them. A topic, and I talk about some of the things I don't do and don't mean to say, including how beliefs change and how the beliefs of younger people, say teenagers, differ considerably from that of adults. Religion is one area in which human beings seem to crave certainty. And that, of course, is another topic. The very discussion of factors and forces which may shape or influence belief can be threatening to some or even shattering to others. The challenge to the believer lies in the relativizing argument, namely that beliefs are relative to the circumstances or conditions which produce or sustain them. When one recognizes that beliefs may be produced in these ways, certainty is brought into question. If one's model or belief system allows for uncertainty, this may pose few problems. If, however, one's religious model or worldview allows for little uncertainty, this very discussion may be a threat. The recent admonition by church leaders that we be very selective in participating in the various unofficial alternative voices might be viewed in this same way. Those involved in these alternative voices should understand the threat they pose for those whose religious views continuously and intensely pervade their belief and behavior, both public and private. Sociologists have observed that, and I'm quoting, fundamentalist revivals in whatever religion take place in times when social changes have led to turmoil, uncertainty, and the erosion of familiar values. When people find themselves confused, threatened, or even appalled at changing conditions, they may see a return to basics as a solution. My experience is that the typical reader of Sunstone lives in a very different world than that of most members of my ward. From my own interaction in the community of Mormons, I can attest to the threat that these differences might pose. I would like to conclude with some positive thoughts about the study of why we believe as we do. To ignore the processes I have talked about earlier is to give them power to influence us in ways we won't recognize. There are powerful distorting forces predisposing us to believe in certain ways. As Professor Bentley summarizes, we believe easily what we hope for earnestly. Do our beliefs lie at the mercy of our hopes, fears, aspirations, and what makes us look good and feel secure? Our knowledge of these influencing forces can enrich the clarity of making our own choices. It should also increase the difficulty of simply submitting to tradition for its own sake. As Peter Berger argues, I would go back to the spirit of relentless honesty, which is not so much disrespectful of established religious authority as ruthless with one's own religious hopes. It is hardly staggering news to suggest that theology should engage in a many-sided conversation with other intellectual disciplines. Everything depends upon the manner in which this many-sided conversation is carried on, and a good deal will depend upon the motives with which it is entered. Any motive other than the search for truth degrades theology or religion, as it degrades any other intellectual enterprise. Thank you.
Let me invite you to stand up and stretch for a moment. I know it's difficult to remain seated for an hour. Those of you who don't stand up, I'm assuming you're exercising your free will not to, and you're comfortable. So,
now, if you sit down, let me just take a few minutes and play the role of commentator. No one knows what a commentator is supposed to do. That means I can do anything I choose and call it comment. What I'd like to start out with is a little examination to determine how well you've listened to the previous two papers. This is an examination that you will answer to yourselves and will not be graded, obviously, and it begins with the question, do you believe blank? So each time I ask you that question, answer for yourself. Do you believe in the Shroud of Turin? Do you believe in the preexistence? Do you believe in angels? Do you believe in life after death? Do you believe in ectoplasm, that which oozes out of the mouths and eyes of mediums? Do you believe in the Holy Ghost? Do you believe in gravity? Do you believe in quarks? Do you believe in ESP? Do you believe in the 3 degrees of glory? Do you believe in phrenology, which is the reading of bumps on heads to determine your personality characteristics? Here's my guess. Some you said yes, some you said no. Here's my next guess. The ones you said yes to come out of your culture and your tradition. If your culture and community is LDS, you said yes probably to the preexistence, to life after death, to angels. I didn't ask you about Satan. Satan's somewhat harder to deal with these days. But the point is raised by the two presenters. Why in the world do you believe some of these things and not others? And maintain those beliefs in the face of no evidence that could be called evidence for any of them, except that at some point in your life you were exposed to some concepts that you came to hold as beliefs. And for other concepts you were not. Arthur Conan Doyle was exposed to spiritualism and it became a central part of his life. Certain Catholics worship relics, or at least pay reverence to relics, because it comes out of a cultural context. What are we trying to say? Beliefs, are they acquired in one way or another? The ways that were presented by Dr. Kohler. Are the knowledge and an understanding from the social sciences, that we get our beliefs from our culture, from other people, from our families, from the social matrix in which we live? What was left off of his list of 6 items that he reviewed with you very quickly was the 7th. We get our beliefs through the witness of the Holy Ghost. Now, why did he leave that off? Some of you, maybe most of you, believe that's how we get our beliefs. The Holy Ghost bears witness. And you have some special individualized knowledge of the truth of something that may have been preceded by prayer or fasting or some other ritualistic activity. I think it was John Stuart Mill who warned us about the deep slumber of decided beliefs. The deep slumber of decided beliefs, for me, says when we put them to rest, we're in trouble. Because these decided beliefs that we believe may have to do with others and not me. They may have been given to me. Or these deep decided beliefs may have to do with myself when I was not who I am today. Came from a different era. Or they may have to do with me, but a different time and a different place. The value, it seems to me, of the papers is that they raise us the question of, do we legitimately examine our beliefs? Should we? Or should we simply accept them because they are ours? The dilemma raised by both papers is this. What I believe is important to me and even sacred. What I believe intimately is true. If what you believe is different, then you must be wrong. Even though your feelings of certainty are equally strong. That's an unsolvable dilemma around which endless arguments have revolved. It seems to me, just as the unexamined life is not worth living, the unexamined belief is not worth having. So how do we examine our beliefs? First of all, we come to some rest over the process of how belief is acquired and held. Do you get your beliefs from your parents? Absolutely. Do you get your beliefs from your culture? There is no question. Is your belief tied up with your identity? Of course it is. Do you believe easily what you hope for earnestly? Absolutely yes. In fact, the more you hope, the more easily you believe. The more tenaciously you hold on to your belief. How do we know those things? Well, in part we believe them, or I believe them. But also we now have a history and a tradition of social science knowledge that helps us understand how people construct and hold beliefs. Are the beliefs of faithful LDS members different from the beliefs, perhaps, about how you raise children? I don't believe so. Does that rule out, in my opinion, the role of the Holy Ghost inspiring you to your belief? I don't think so. Let me make a comment which I find powerful. I wrote it. You may find unintelligible or even controversial. We cannot be counted upon as individuals to end up with the right belief. I cannot be depended upon to come up by myself with the right belief. Self-deception is one of my greatest games, as it is yours. You may end up deceiving yourself into a belief that is not true. There are many traps and pitfalls. We do, in fact, believe easily those things that convince us, that convenience us, that we hope for. In order to make sense of our beliefs in the context of what we've heard, we need to find the historical context and tradition of our belief. We have to set it somewhere. It has to be in place so that it makes sense as it connects up to other things. Many of us have beliefs that we would call, if they were examined, they would be called delusions. Not many other people hold them. They start out as children with accidents. Step on a crack, you break your mother's back. All sorts of primitive, childish beliefs are acquired as we grow up. Sometimes we don't give those up. We call them in some context superstitions, biases, prejudices. We need to focus on internal consistencies of our beliefs. We heard in the papers about internal consistency, about consistencies. But if you hold two beliefs that are absolutely contradictory, in the common sense, something is not working. We need to feel unthreatened enough to examine our own consistencies, our own biases, and our own prejudices. And most importantly, we need others who can teach us about our beliefs. One of the characteristics that has to do with how we come to believe is we believe in the social context. We believe in the context of community. We are taught by others what to believe. And yet we change those beliefs so they become our own. Little variations and modifications. If we don't find ourselves in an environment that's safe enough so that we can talk and share our beliefs and be taught and corrected and teach and correct, then we don't grow and change in our beliefs. And few of us, or not many of us in my experience, have those safe environments where we can expose our beliefs, strange as they may be, and ask people to react to them. In the first paper by Mr. Homer, he leaves us with a dilemma. The dilemma is the shroud doesn't convince except to the believers. The letters, the forgeries that turned out to be forgeries, didn't convince except to the believers. The principle is you have to believe first. It isn't seeing is believing, it's believing is seeing. Until you believe, you cannot see. Until you believe, you cannot find. Until you believe, you cannot make sense. So belief comes first, and then the evidence. Those people who believe in the shroud, I think it's a fake, a phony. That's my belief. It contradicts other people's belief. But those people who do believe, believe sincerely with great faith. So one conclusion I would raise from the first paper is belief is not enough. Being sincere is not enough. We do not like, as was pointed out by Dr. Kohler, we do not like to examine our beliefs as threatening, as his students reported. In the second paper, now by way of conclusion, let me read to you a question that he proposes in page 2 and then deals with at the end. Do Mormons come to their religious beliefs in the same manner or through the same processes of people of other faiths? Or do we have a special gift? My belief, after reading your paper and listening, is you didn't answer that very clearly. I'm not entirely sure what you believe about that statement. My belief, since I get to comment, and commenting is anything I want to do, is to say to you, yes, our beliefs are acquired and held in the same manner that other people's beliefs are. In our religious tradition, we have a Holy Ghost experience and a Spirit of Christ experience, which witnesses to a special elect group, us, and to the people at large about the truth of things. Intuition, inspiration, revelation. Again, by way of conclusion, that experience, whatever it means to you as an emotional experience, cannot be depended upon exclusively. Many people have borne witness to the message from the Holy Ghost and have been out of sync, out of context, and simply wrong about their beliefs. I was a student at BYU, and the traditional one was the energetic young man who says to the young woman, "It has been revealed to me that you should marry me." And I believe that with all of my heart. I have a burning in my bosom, and she is taken aback and perplexed. It's a silly example, but the example has connections to other people's belief. We do, in fact, and it's been repeated here, believe easily what we want to believe. Psychologically, it is a characteristic that we share. Ending. Robert Frost wrote a poem that starts like this. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Sometimes when we are presented with two alternatives, we want them both. Choosing is difficult. It requires us to stand up and be counted. It requires us to take a position. Is it possible that we are like other people in how we acquire and hold our beliefs? Or, the other road, do we insist that we have a specialized channel through which beliefs come that is only ours? I choose the road least traveled by, as Frost said, and that has made all of the difference. I believe there is nothing wrong with understanding that our beliefs are subject to looking and examining and exploring and even modifying as we grow and change. That's what I call coming to understanding. And I think it's as important in the religious area as it is in the intellectual area. The papers have stimulated me to think more about my beliefs, and I hope they've done the same thing for you. Thank you.
We have 5 minutes for questions from the audience. Anybody? I'd like to thank our participants. And I think of the missionary that came home from his from Japan a few weeks ago and gave his mission speech. And he said, you know, in Japan, they believe there's only one path to the top of, there are many paths to the top of Mount Fuji, but we as Mormons know there is only one.